Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Leak, Politics, Activists, and Loss of Trust at Brookhaven National Laboratory, by Robert P. Kreese with Peter D. Bond, narrated by Keith Sellenwright. Prologue. In 1997, a leak of water containing radioactivity was discovered at Brookhaven National Laboratory. Though federal, state, and local officials declared that it posed no health hazard either to the lab's employees or to the surrounding community, it triggered a media and political firestorm. In its wake came a startling series of events that included the firing of Brookhaven's corporate manager, changes in the lab's leadership, transformation of the lab's culture, significant alterations to management contracts of Department of Energy scientific facilities, the permanent closure of the lab's research reactor, and even calls to close the lab itself. While 1997 was the lab's 50th anniversary, it was a year of chaos rather than celebration. A quarter of a century later, in a period of social and political uncertainty when the value and authority of science are urgently needed, it is vital to look back on this episode. Amid the unruly happenings, one can make out fault lines between scientists, politicians, media, and the public that have only grown larger and more intractable. The story of the events at Brookhaven in 1997 exposes dangers that U.S. science faces now and in the foreseeable future, and illustrates lessons about the management of large scientific facilities that need to be learned or relearned. This book is therefore about not just Brookhaven National Laboratory, but the kinds of social and political dynamics on which the existence of scientific facilities such as Brookhaven continue to depend. Though the health and safety impact of Brookhaven's leak was negligible, activists and the media at times applied sensationalist language to the episode. While such language would have been appropriate to Chernobyl, Bhopal, and the Challenger launch disasters, it was not to the BNL leak. The story therefore helps shed light on current controversies where suspicions and fears, combined with loss of trust and political ambitions, strongly shape controversies involving issues with scientific and technical dimensions, such as the safety of vaccines, the reality of climate change, and the dangers of toxic chemicals, for starters. We were there. Kreese, a Stony Brook University faculty member, is a philosopher and historian of science who was then finishing a book on the lab's first half century. Bond had worked at the lab for 25 years and began 1997 as chair of the physics department. He was then proposed as the lab's interim director twice during the year and appointed once. He has written an article about his personal experiences. Both are referred to here in the third person. This makes us interested parties who might be viewed as biased in presenting the story. Then, and now, we found many of the unfolding events to be like the plot twists in some outrageous tragicomedy whose spectrum of vivid characters ranged from cultivated to clownish. However, the passage of more than 25 years, together with our subsequent experiences, have allowed us, we hope, to look back more insightfully and with fresh eyes. We also had unprecedented access to many participants, internal emails, and the minutes of key meetings, which put us in a special position to observe and judge the actors, events, and dynamics. Despite our roles, we have striven to make our account, based on data, documents, and interviews, not simply one side or perspective to be set among and against others, but a picture in which, we hope, all participants can recognize themselves. And we hope it demonstrates the lessons that everyone concerned about the present-day threats to human health and welfare need to draw from the episode. 1. The leak discovered. Radioactive pollution does not have to be injurious to health to be socially undesirable. Bernard Manowitz, Brookhaven National Laboratory, 1949. Tritium. Late on January 8, 1997, Doug Peckett, a hydrogeologist at Brookhaven National Laboratory, BNL, received an analysis of groundwater samples near the lab's high-flux beam reactor, HFBR. The analysis showed a level of tritium, a radioactive form of hydrogen, above the Environmental Protection Agency's drinking water standard. He shot back a request to confirm the results, adding that this could be a very tricky situation. Brookhaven National Laboratory is a world-famous scientific institution located in New York's Suffolk County in eastern Long Island. It had been established in 1947 by a contract between a consortium of 9 prominent universities in the Northeast, known as Associated Universities, Inc., AUI, and the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC, as a place to bring the resources of American academia and government together to build and operate scientific instruments whose scale was too big for individual universities to afford. The lab's major instruments would include particle accelerators and nuclear reactors. The first reactors had been built for military purposes as a part of the Manhattan Project, but reactors were also essential for non-military scientific research throughout virtually all areas of science. The Department of Energy, DOE, eventually became the owner of the U.S. National Labs, so that in 1997, Brookhaven was owned by the DOE and operated by AUI, subject to the DOE's regulations and oversight. Brookhaven's research spanned many fields, including physics, chemistry, biology, engineering, medicine, and others. By the beginning of its half-centennial, in 1997, the lab's research had resulted in 4 Nobel Prizes, now 7, more than any other laboratory worldwide in a comparable period. Yet, despite Brookhaven's eminence, it had become vulnerable. In the wake of Peckett's finding, an array of elements – Suffolk County's history, Long Island's geology, environmental concerns, and changing demographics – combined with poorly considered actions by lab and government officials, an anti-nuclear movement, political exposure, media coverage, celebrities, and the challenge of risk communication even in the best of circumstances, led to the dismissal of AUI, the closure of the HFBR, and calls to close the lab itself. For a few days, neither the public nor local politicians knew of Peckett's findings as he rechecked them. When he got confirmation, he alerted his bosses in the Environmental Health and Safety, ES&H, division, and scheduled an emergency meeting to draw up an occurrence report, as required by the DOE. His bosses scheduled a joint meeting with the lab's reactor division for Monday morning. Before leaving work on Friday, Peckett used his knowledge of the groundwater flow to devise a plan to install more monitoring wells, both to find the tritium source and to see if it was an active leak or previous spill. It would be the last weekend for months that many employees in the lab's administration, ES&H, and media relations would spend at home. On Monday morning, January 13th, the ES&H group reviewed the discovery. It did not appear to pose a danger to health from a scientific perspective. It was deep underground, and tritium, a form of hydrogen whose nucleus consists of a proton and 2 neutrons, emits a weak form of radiation, beta decay, that does not penetrate skin and travels only an inch in air. A sheet of paper stops its radiation. Tritium combines with oxygen to make water and is used in a variety of ways. Biomedical researchers use it as a tracer. Hydrologists put it in groundwater to trace the flow, and oceanographers inject it into the sea to track currents. It is widely used in self-illuminating exit signs and luminous watches. Tritium in the groundwater is a health hazard Only if humans drink it, and then only at a high enough concentration in sufficient quantities. The drinking water standard set by the EPA is based on a limit equivalent of a person drinking 2 liters of water at 20,000 picocuries per liter per day per year, 14,600,000 picocuries total per year. In this case, the scientists were alarmed because tritium was found in monitoring wells on-site near the reactor, and more importantly, because its origin was unknown. The group brainstormed for ideas about the possible source and assigned individuals to investigate each. Some members of the group thought it too early to spread the news. Bill Gunther, head of the BNL Office of Environmental Restoration, OER, was one. The data were sparse. The tritium was no health hazard, and as a Superfund site since 1989, the lab's environmental restoration staff had far more pressing problems to worry about involving certain chemical contamination issues, though these, too, did not pose a danger to health. Tritium's half-life is 12.3 years, and it would spread and dilute in the slow-moving groundwater, all but vanishing by the time it reached the lab's border a mile and a half away. Nevertheless, the group alerted lab director Nicholas Semios, who asked the group a series of questions. Do you believe the numbers? Yes. What's the source? We don't know. Are you sure it's not the reactor vessel? Yes. Are you sure it's the reactor? No. Are you sure it's not the reactor drains? No. What are other possibilities? The spent fuel pool, some source upstream of the reactor. The HFBR happened to be shut down for routine maintenance, and Semios decided to keep it shut until the source was found and stopped. He ordered Paquette to implement his plan to install more wells and notified Martha Krebs, head of the DOE's Office of Energy Research, now called the Office of Science, in Washington, D.C. Brookhaven was seeking to upgrade the HFBR, and among other things, Semios wanted to be sure the DOE appreciated the lab's concern for safety and the environment. Krebs ordered Semios to get DOE approval for any press releases on the subject. Such approvals would each take days, for they would have to go up the bureaucratic chain from the DOE's on-site office through its Chicago Operations Office that oversaw numerous labs, including BNL, and only then to the DOE's Washington, D.C. office and to its secretary, a cabinet official. 2 days later, Paquette's first new monitoring wells, called geoprobes after the company that made them, were pounded into the HFBR lawn. Data from these would allow him to plan a second and third round to pin down the tritium's location and extent in what would soon comprise a network of 24 monitoring wells. Meanwhile, lab officials distributed data, maps of wells and water contours, and a list of intended actions to federal, state, and local regulatory agencies. Lab staff combed the HFBR's records, began testing pipes, drains, sewers, and the pool where the reactor's used fuel rods were stored, and put together a plan for how to plot the extent of the tritium, deal with it, and distribute the information. On Thursday, Mona Rowe, the lab's head of media relations, left for a prearranged luncheon with the Southampton Rotary Club, which had asked her to talk about the lab's legacy environmental issues. As the DOE had still not approved release of the news, she could say nothing about the tritium discovery. The next day, Semios sent a memo to employees about the finding, assuring them that it didn't affect drinking water or safety. That Friday happened to be a bittersweet moment for the lab's media and communications staff, as that evening, Janet Sillis, its flamboyant office administrator of 23 years and a talented singer, was performing at her own retirement party. Rowe, another talented musician, was accompanying her on piano. In the middle of Sillis's signature song, Broadway Baby, A woman from the office of Sue Davis, Associate Director for Reactor Safety and Security, slipped into the room, placed a document on the piano music rack in front of Roe, and whispered,
"The DOE-approved press release."
When the song ended, Roe dashed to a phone to call Davis. Reporters know that Friday nights are the traditional time for organizations to announce bad news, and even with a pre-programmed media fax list, the release would not get out until after 9 p.m. Fearing the optics, she convinced the DOE to let her postpone release until the next morning, which would give the media a full day to develop the story and contact sources. Roe and her boss arrived at 7 a.m. on January 18th and handled press queries for the entire day. A week had passed since Paquette had confirmed the tritium finding, and while all of the appropriate regulatory reporting had occurred, the public had only just been made aware. However, two congressmen, Senator Alphonse D'Amato and Representative Michael Forbes, had not been alerted. This primed Paquette's tricky situation to erupt. The next week, the ES&H staff frantically analyzed the geoprobe data. Tritium was only found south in the groundwater from the reactor, so its source was evidently in that building. But it was difficult to form a clear picture with data coming in from different wells at different depths. At 7 p.m. on January 25th, a baffled Bob Miltenberger wrote Paquette, "For those of you who thought more data would help us understand this issue, read these data tables and please help me understand what is going on." Paquette puzzled over the data, and an hour before midnight wrote back, "The data does make some sense." He outlined his view of the tritium's location, but cautiously warned that he needed more data from the probes that he had ordered installed that Monday morning, January 27th. 2 days later, Davis, Gunther, and others drew up and handed DOE officials their completed tritium plume recovery plan, a comprehensive program to identify the size and source of the area with tritium, implement short and long-term corrective actions, plan the eventual restart of the HFBR, and convey the information to the relevant people and agencies. Davis began sending the local DOE office, every few days, extensive tables of the results of analysis of every well sample. On January 31st, Samios sent lab employees a memo about the first phase of Paquette's test wells. Levels of tritium in the groundwater were 11 times the drinking water standard 100 feet south of the reactor building, dropping off farther away. More wells would soon give a better picture. Samios wrote that the EPA was independently analyzing the samples, and the data showed no contamination of drinking water or threat to either lab employees or neighbors. Samios also set in motion a second phase of Paquette's plan to find the source. Samios, and most of the rest of the lab scientists, saw the issues posed by the tritium discovery as a simple matter. Look at the numbers, see what the harm is, and if there's any, fix it. But that's not how others saw the issues. A History of Troubled Waters. "While nothing could seem simpler than a clear glass of water," writes James Salzman, "it is difficult to find a more complex or fascinating topic." "Drinking water is infused with symbolism and myth," says Salzman, a professor of law and environmental policy at Duke University, and author of Drinking Water, A History. "Stigma can be attached to groundwater where the amounts of chemicals in it are so low that it doesn't matter, which makes whether it is safe or not difficult to discuss. We need to find a way to discuss more honestly and openly what we mean by safe drinking water." The difficulty of discussing the safety of the groundwater in 1997 at Brookhaven National Laboratory was amplified by the presence of its unique geography, history, and personalities. The geographical issue was that the island's drinking water comes from its uppermost aquifer, or water-containing mass of sand and gravel, deposited by a glacier that sits over a layer of clay but below ground level. Containing around 70 trillion tons of water, it is Long Island's sole source aquifer, replenished by rain seeping in through the soil. The historical issue was that when Brookhaven opened in 1947, eastern Long Island was sparsely populated and inhabitants paid scant attention to groundwater purity. Ringed with beaches and fishing villages on the coast, the island's interior had a monotonous landscape of pitch pine and scrub oak and various types of farms. The lab was built on the site of Camp Upton, a decommissioned army camp in the middle of the island, used in both world wars. The remoteness of the location had been a reason for the location of both camp and lab. But Suffolk County grew rapidly. Highways and railroads brought it within commuting distance of New York City, and it developed and suburbanized, surpassing its neighbor Nassau County, about 40 miles west of Brookhaven, as the fastest-growing suburban county in the country. Vacation homes for the wealthy sprang up, especially at the far end of Long Island's South Fork, in towns collectively known as the Hamptons, about 40 miles east of the lab. Right after World War II, the county's population of about 250,000 mainly lined the shores, but half a century later the population of around 1,400,000 was scattered throughout the region. With Long Island's development and industrialization came environmental issues. Plumes of fertilizer, gasoline, pesticides, degreaser, and oil that slowly absorbed into the soil. Homeowners routinely disposed of solvents, now collectively known as volatile organic compounds, VOCs, in the ground, and until the 1970s were encouraged to put safe degreasers and other solvents into cesspools. Service stations, factories, industries, and BNL used solvents to clean equipment, and they too frequently disposed of them by pouring them into the ground. At Camp Upton, solvents had been used to clean uniforms, tents, rifles, and other gear, and were mixed with paint. Other contaminants were dumped into the ground by Precision Concepts, an electronics fabrication company in an industrial park at the lab's southern boundary. Liquid contaminants would make their way into the groundwater, which moves slowly south about a foot per day at most. Other contaminants would generally combine with soil and not move far. Fortunately, an aquifer is not an underground lake, where a drop of liquid immediately spreads, but more like a giant sandbox, where a drop flows down gradient slowly in a plume and can, in principle, be cleaned up. In the 1970s, in an awakening of environmental sensitivity, the United States began to regulate solvents, degreasers, pesticides, and other chemicals. Brookhaven scientists shared this environmental concern. Lab researchers were a driving force in founding the Environmental Defense Fund, and the EDF's Certificate of Incorporation, 1967, was signed in a lab conference room. The lab scientists' environmental activism sometimes caused friction in neighboring communities. Many areas of Long Island, including the lab, had plumes that now exceeded acceptable levels. In 1989, the lab, joining a list of 20 other areas on Long Island, became a Superfund site, a program administered by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to identify and clean up areas of hazardous waste. Part of the Superfund process involves surveys to identify and remediate legacy events and practices that resulted in environmental pollution, and the lab began a historical legacy survey to systematically track and clean pockets of VOCs and other contamination. Some chemical plumes, including those from the Camp Upton days, were too deep, 180 to 200 feet or so down, to be a health hazard, for most people's wells reached down 60 to 80 feet. Tritium, a byproduct of normal operation of the HFBR, was regularly released in the lab's waste discharge into the Peconic River, which effectively originates on site, but at levels a fraction of the drinking water standard. The lab began work on a state-of-the-art waste management facility and an upgrade of its sewage treatment plant to replace the ones in use since the lab was founded in 1947. The lab also undertook a joint program with the Suffolk County Department of Health Services, SCDHS, to find chemicals that had gone off-site. At Brookhaven, each contaminated area at the lab was made a separate cleanup project, called an operable unit, and six were ultimately created. A Superfund project involves a formalized set of procedures for investigation, cleanup, and community engagement that operated autonomously with respect to the other lab activities focused on science. Following those procedures, the lab established a community relations and outreach program, whose head was Kathy Geiger, a former journalistic researcher. Geiger reported to OER head Bill Gunther, who in turn reported to Associate Director for Reactor Safety and Security, Sue Davis. The program issued quarterly public newsletters, set regular open meetings on cleanup practices, and established relationships with civic associations. Besides the lab's Superfund status, three other developments had also ratcheted up environmental sensitivities on Long Island. One was an anti-nuclear movement sparked by an attempt to build a nuclear power plant on the North Shore. The second was reports that incidences of breast cancer on parts of Long Island were unusually high. The third was publicity surrounding cases in other parts of the country where industries had created and then covered up extensive chemical contamination, causing incidences of cancer and other diseases. Long Island's anti-nuclear movement was crystallized by a nuclear power plant that the Long Island Lighting Company began building in the late 1960s in Shoreham, a Suffolk County town 10 miles north of the lab. The recently passed National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, mandated public hearings for such projects. Starting in 1976, local and national anti-nuclear activists staged highly effective protests at the hearings, targeted at newspaper and television audiences. Long Island environmental lawyer Irving Like, a key anti-Shoreham activist, advised that the hearings should become a multimedia confrontation, saying, "Each day must become a dramatic and suspenseful event. Phrase statements in a lively manner, which will read or sound well when recorded in the next day's press or radio account." The protests succeeded in terminating the facility in 1989 as it was on the verge of operation. In the wake of the 1979 accident at Three Mile Island and the 1986 Chernobyl accident in the USSR, involving power reactors of 800 and 1,000 megawatts, respectively, rumors of nuclear cover-ups and conspiracies acquired new currency and vibrancy. Brookhaven National Laboratory had two operating research reactors, the HFBR, 30 megawatts, and the much smaller Brookhaven Medical Research Reactor, BMRR, 3 megawatts, as well as the remnants of the closed and mostly decommissioned Brookhaven Graphite Research Reactor, BGRR, 32 megawatts. Reactors and radiation are associated with nuclear weaponry and accidents and arouse particularly strong fears and emotions. When Roe's sister asked how she could choose to work near a nuclear reactor, Roe replied by asking how her sister could choose to live near the San Andreas Fault. These fears and emotions make it exceptionally challenging to establish and defend acceptable safety levels, especially when those establishing and defending them are from the institutions responsible for the radiation in the first place. The second development occurred in the wake of a Long Island breast cancer study initiated by New York State health scientists, which found that from 1978 to 1982, the incidence of breast cancer in Nassau County was 12% above the New York State rate and 7.5% above the U.S. rate, although in Suffolk County it was barely above average. This study fostered breast cancer activism inspiring citizens to organize to collect information and compile maps of possible cancer clusters, and to pressure for more scientific studies about possible connections between the local environment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?